Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The one and likely only debate for California governor took place this weekend. Governor Gavin Newsom and Republican State Senator Brian Dahle sparred over differing views of moving the state forward. Whether it moved the needle is an entirely different question, given it aired Sunday afternoon competing with the NFL. It also re-aired Monday in place of Insight. The gubernatorial debate was moderated by our colleagues at KQED in the Bay Area. Cap Radio Politics reporter Nicole Nixon was there and joins us with analysis. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning.
So let's start with some context. It wasn't even guaranteed that there would be a debate this midterm. How did we get here? Why the location? Why the time?
Yeah, about a month ago, it was not clear whether these two would have a debate. Newsom did one debate 4 years ago when he was first running for governor, and it was a similar thing. This aired on the radio on KQED. It was like 10 a.m. on a Monday, which was also a federal holiday. So a similar story this time, Sunday afternoon debate, overlapped with 49ers and Chargers games, as you mentioned. So it wouldn't be a surprise if most Californians were not tuning into this on a Sunday afternoon. And this debate may have been at an inconvenient time. It may not have even changed anyone's mind about who they're going to vote for. But I'm a firm believer that debates like this are good for democracy. They're good for voters. It's good to get candidates on the record and ask where they stand on certain issues. It's also an opportunity to hold elected officials accountable and have actual policy debates on the merits of policies.
And I share that as well, Nicole. So for those who aren't familiar with State Senator Brian Dahle, who is he and what led him to running for governor? Because he wasn't part of the recall last year.
Right. Brian Dahle is a state senator. He represents this sprawling rural district in Northeast California. He's been in the legislature for 10 years. In his campaign for governor, he's talked about the high cost of living in this state, increasing energy prices and the threat of blackouts. Crime is a big thing among Republicans in the state. He also is hitting persisting problems like homelessness, drought, and mega fires on the campaign trail.
What I found was interesting with this debate is there weren't strict time limits when it came to responses. Was that a successful approach?
You know, I think it allowed candidates to respond to each other, and it certainly allowed for a few deep dives on issues like this debate over gas prices and whether pausing the gas taxes Republicans are calling for would actually reduce what Californians are paying at the pump. So I think it did work in this instance.
Given you were there, you took this all in, you know, getting a broad brushstroke from you. When you left, what was the big overall headline or takeaway from this debate? Was it consistent with what you expected going in, or were there some surprises?
You know, I've covered many of these debates where there's one candidate, Newsom in this case, who has a huge advantage just because of the name recognition, the incumbency, the fact that Democratic voters outnumber Republicans 2-1 in California. And debates like this can be very boring. But this debate was not as boring as I thought it might be. They were very cordial. They weren't afraid to go after each other, though. And you definitely got those moments. And again, they did get pretty deep on certain issues, which is always good.
Yeah, you touched upon gas prices. There was so much back and forth over gas, understandably. I mean, the causes for these extraordinarily high prices, as well as solutions, claims, criticism, literally left and right, each saying that that's not true to the other candidate. So get us through all of that noise. What were the main arguments they were making?
Sure. So the main arguments on the gas prices and gas tax, Brian Dahle's arguing that gas prices are high in California because of state government taxes and regulations, which is true to some extent. We do have the highest gas tax in the country. It's about 53 cents per gallon. There are additional environmental fees on top of that. But energy experts say that on average, that doesn't fully account for how much higher the average gas prices are here in California. They're saying there's about, you know, 50 to 70 cents per gallon extra that cannot be accounted for. It's also sometimes called this mystery surcharge. And energy experts say that that 50, 70 cents is likely just going directly to oil companies as profit. And that's the point that Newsom was making. He's arguing, and I'm quoting here, that oil companies are ripping you off. And he plans to call this special session in December if he wins election. after the election, and he wants to have lawmakers pass what he's calling a windfall tax, which presumably would tax that profit and return it to taxpayers. But Newsom has not given much detail other than that about how this would actually work and whether it would work. So that was a lot of debate time spent on those two points.
Yeah. And State Senator Dahle joined Republican lawmakers in wanting to suspend the gas tax.
Right.
Right. Homelessness obviously is an issue that has not. It's just grown despite unprecedented investments. During the debate, Newsom said, you know, $15.3 billion has been devoted to this. Did they get beyond talking points to actual solutions?
On this issue, it was pretty limited to talking points. Dahle said that homelessness is an example of an issue where the state's Democratic leaders have, as he says, just thrown money at a problem. But it's like worse than ever. The number of unsheltered people in California is growing. And Newsom said that it is unacceptable. He also mentioned that when he took office 4 years ago, there was no statewide plan for homelessness, almost no money. And he's talked about things like his Home Key project, which converted hotels into housing during the pandemic. He talked about how new funding for local governments would come with certain accountability measures to ensure that cities are working to house people. But those are all talking points that he's used over the past couple of years.
Yeah. The governor also led with Prop 1. And so let's get to the topic of abortion. Senator Dahle is pro-life. So I want you to help unpack a couple moments surrounding his views, because they did go back and forth about this. Mm-hmm. I was kind of left unclear with how he would use his authority as governor by veto or executive order to restrict or ban funding and policies surrounding abortion. Let's listen to his response.
And I would absolutely take that out of the budget.
There's money. There's money in the budget. Reproductive services. Not all for out-of-state travel.
No,
right.
So,
line item all.
Right. I will absolutely fund reproductive services, but I am not going to fund out-of-state abortions.
What about in-state abortions?
No, I will propose that, yes, I'm pro-life. I don't think we should. Reproductive services, absolutely.
So you'll take out of the budget any help with women.
Right, I have to get that through the, no governor has full control of the budget. He has to work with the legislature, and I'll work with the legislature to put a budget together that will work.
He's kind of like on a verbal tightrope there. What did you get from his response?
Yeah, so to back up, the legislature approved about $250 million for expanded reproductive services after the Supreme Court decision overturning Roe versus Wade. A few things here. He is right that the governor does not have full control over the budget. The legislature passes it. The governor can do line item vetoes, but the legislature can, you know, overrule vetoes. He definitely was on a tightrope. Once that money leaves the state and it goes to like reproductive providers in the form of grants, the state doesn't really have control over how those groups use it. And so having him saying that he would approve money for reproductive services, but not abortions. Abortions are reproductive services. I don't think that, you know, the state can give money with those kinds of strings attached.
Mm. Yeah. And that's probably explains why he gave the response that he gave, which is kind of convoluted. You know, Dahle also didn't refute Governor Newsom's claim, and it was pretty bold, that he is against abortion, even in cases of rape and incest. And we're going to listen to a really extreme scenario that the governor posed.
What my opponent believes is some 10-year-old that's raped by her father should be forced to bear her brother or sister. His position is extreme.
And what surprised me was Senator Dahle was silent in his response. There was even like a moment of pause to see if he would say something. So is his stance, in fact, no abortions, no exceptions?
I mean, he did not come out and say, yes, I do believe that. But like you said, these debates give candidates an opportunity to get on the record and make their positions very clear. And he did not come out and refute that. So,
yeah. Senator Dahle also took on Prop 1, which is voters are going to vote on come the midterm. It would put the right to abortion in the state constitution. He claimed that it would extend the right to abortion beyond what is currently allowed, which is within, you know, the first 6 months, the first two trimesters, to a, quote, a minute before birth. Is that correct?
Well, before we get to that, the fact is that nationally, the vast majority of abortion procedures, 99%, occur before 21 weeks. And doctors say that abortions that happen later in the pregnancy are usually because of severe medical complications. And they're usually a pregnancy that is wanted. So that person is often not happy or devastated to be ending that pregnancy later. Currently, state law does outlaw abortion past the point of fetal viability. That's usually around 21 to 24 weeks. After that, abortion's only legal when it would risk the life or health of the pregnant person to continue with that pregnancy. Opponents of Prop 1 are arguing as dahlias that that would overrule state law and open the door for abortions way later. Authors of the bill say it would not change state law.
Okay. Well, that thank you for that context. A good amount of time also devoted to climate policies, water, drought, phasing out fossil fuels. I mean, the list was long with this. What was the big message you took away from their views?
There was a big, large debate about drought and water storage. Republicans and Daly in this debate were hammering Newsom on, you know, not creating any new reservoir water storage in the last 4 years. And there was actually a moment about 40 minutes in where they were debating this. And I thought that it really encapsulated both candidates' strategies in this debate, which is where Newsom was kind of painting Daly as using talking points or being a lawmaker that opposes policies passed by Democrats but doesn't offer any alternative solutions. And then Daly was talking about Newsom just kind of throwing money at a problem and hoping it goes away. So let's listen to this moment.
You're just laying out talking points, but no substance. The form and substance only a fog in terms of the dilution of reality and facts that you are promoting here today on these critical topics for the people of the state.
Senator Daly, quick response, and then I want to move on to homework.
I want to just say the dilution of facts is he keeps talking about the party I represent. That party hasn't been in hasn't had control in this state for almost 30 years, Governor. Why are all these problems not fixed? Because your policies are horrible. Californians know it. At the end of the day, you talk, you throw money, Californians are suffering, and you haven't solved the problem.
Yeah. Where did Senator Daly have the greatest edge?
You know, inflation is the top issue on voters' minds right now, and it is a global problem. There's really not much elected officials can actually do about it, but the cost of living has been an issue in California for a long time. I think it was effective for Daly to hammer that, but I think he could have presented more detailed ideas about, for example, whether cutting certain regulations would result in, like, a certain number of savings for families.
Where was the governor at his strongest?
I think Newsom had clearly brushed up on Daly's voting record throughout his time in the legislature. And I think it was effective because he could use that voting record against Daly and dispute some of the claims he made. Like, he did this with his climate package, Newsom's climate package. When Daly said that he believes climate change is a problem and we should, you know, fix it, Newsom could say, well, then why didn't you vote for these bills that would have reduced fossil fuel emissions that I proposed.
Did they agree on anything?
There was one thing at the very end they did agree on. It was pretty unexpected. Newsom was asked about whether he'll support recommendations from this task force that's currently studying potential forms of reparations for Black Californians. And Daly said he supports that task force. I looked up his vote. He did vote for it. And he also supported a bill Newsom recently signed that returned land in L.A. County known as Bruce's Beach to a Black family that had been taken from nearly 100 years ago.
You know, Daly also repeatedly said from the beginning that the governor is running for president. I mean, that was a big talking point that he hit home. Governor Newsom committed on the record to serving a full 4-year term if reelected. How much weight do you put behind these statements?
I thought it was smart for Daly to get that in right at the beginning. Newsom's aspirations for potential higher office are a huge point of speculation right now. So, yes, Newsom did commit to completing the 4-year term, but he really didn't say much beyond a yes. And since this is the subject of so much speculation, I'm a little surprised that he didn't do more to try to put some of those rumors to rest.
Yeah. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Cap Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon, providing analysis following what will likely be the only gubernatorial debate between Governor Newsom and Republican State Senator Brian Daly. Overall, did you have to do a lot of fact checking, or were their claims overall straightforward and truthful?
I did a few fact checks. There were some claims about campaign donations. Newsom accused Daly of taking hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign donations from big oil companies, and Daly said he hadn't received a cent. He has, in fact, received at least one $20,000 donation from an oil and gas company and thousands more from people employed in that industry. So neither of them were correct on that one.
Following the debate, there were press conferences, especially with the governor. What was discussed at the press conference from Newsom?
Yeah, one thing Newsom said is that he called on Kevin DeLeon and Gil Cedillo, the two remaining members of the L.A. City Council caught up in this scandal about racist remarks, called on them to resign. He said he initially did not call for any of those people to resign, but has since changed and said that he thinks they should resign now. He said he wanted to give them space at the beginning, but now says it's time.
You know, I'm following the president as well. Senator Dolly, did he hold a press conference after?
He did. He came out. He answered questions from reporters. He mentioned in the debate that he's hosted over 100 fellow state lawmakers in his district over the past decade. And afterward, he talked a little bit more about that. He's invited Newsom out to go fishing in his district, but the governor has not taken him up on it yet. But he's talked about how that kind of across the aisle relationship building has helped him as a lawmaker, and talked about how that's a strategy he would bring if he was elected governor.
Finally, Nicole, this is a final stretch of a political marathon for you. So you're full steam ahead. You're probably not even focusing on the debate anymore because you have another debate to focus on. You're going to be co-moderating this one on Thursday for the newly drawn, just massive Congressional District 3. This is really a part two for you following a debate that you co-moderated in the primary. It's going to be airing on KCRA, of course, Cap Radio on Thursday. Remind us who the candidates are and what stands out to you about this race.
Yeah, the general election candidates are Republican Kevin Kiley. He's currently a member of the state assembly, been in that seat since 2016. And he's become a vocal critic in recent years of Governor Newsom, his administration, and many of these policies approved by Democrats in the legislature. He's facing Democrat Kermit Jones, who's a Navy veteran and a doctor. It's an interesting race because, like you said, it's a new district. The boundaries are very different, and it's huge. It goes all the way from Lake Tahoe to Death Valley. So we'll be asking the candidates about important issues. That debate is Thursday at 7 p.m. here on Cap Radio and KCRA.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Nicole.
Thank you.
That is Cap Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon. Up next, the affordable housing crisis is tough enough, but for LGBTQ plus community, especially seniors, it's even more difficult. We'll talk about one solution that is already underway in Sacramento. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The affordable housing crisis in California is well known, only to be exacerbated from the pandemic, now inflation, to cost of building, regulations, the list really goes on and on. Some of the hardest hit are seniors, especially on fixed incomes. In the most extreme cases, many are forced onto the street. For LGBTQ plus seniors, the challenge to find affordable housing has been even more difficult, as the community has faced historic discrimination, along with all the other issues that come with finding a safe, affordable place to call home. Earlier this year, the city of Sacramento opened a new community called Lavender Courtyard to address the dire need for an affordable place for LGBTQ plus seniors to call home. It was led by an organization called Mutual Housing California. Joining us now is the CEO of Mutual Housing California, Roberto Jimenez, and we're happy to have a resident of Lavender Courtyard, Francesca Dixon, or Cheska. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Roberto, I want to start with you. Tell us how and why Lavender Courtyard Courtyard came about and why it's important to have this project in Sacramento.
Levin Courtyard started organically. It was a group of folks in the community, a number of elders in the community who saw a demand for housing, and they started organizing for it. My predecessor, Rachel Liska, the CEO of Mutual Housing at the time, joined that group, and she found the resources to move the project forward and partnered with the city.
How many apartments are there?
There are 53 units.
53 units. So obviously, due to fair housing laws, you know, Lavender Courtyard cannot restrict who resides there based on sex or gender identity. But are you able to gauge if the community is reflective of the goal that you set forth?
Yeah, I think we haven't actually tested that in any way, but we do know what occurs in these sorts of situations. I've talked to my colleagues across the country, and it tends to be that about 60 to 70% of the folks who end up living there would identify as LGBT+.
Cheska, that brings me to you. What led to you becoming a resident at Lavender Courtyard?
I needed a safe place to live in the past, since 2020. I've lived five different places, and three of them were highly transphobic. And, as soon as the lottery was open, I applied, and I love it. I feel safe. I can be myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is so important. I would imagine that by living at Lavender Courtyard, the fact that you moved five times since 2020, it changed your life for the better since you moved in.
Absolutely. I was always on the bubble of homelessness. I could barely afford rent. In the houses where I rented a room that were the house, they were transphobic. It was really stressful. And I was in physical danger. And now I'm safe. And I love Lavender Courtyard. We all get along. It's really amazing. Yeah.
What can you tell us, obviously with respecting people's privacy, about the community there, your neighbors? And, you know, because there's probably so many stories that everyone has their own individual lived experience, but so many stories that you can relate to, I would imagine, at Lavender Courtyard.
Yeah, and a lot of people have more compelling stories than me. I know people who lived in their, I know one person who lived in their car for 5 years, another person who lived out of their pickup truck for another eight. It's a mixed community. I would venture to say that at least half is LGBTQ, but there's no issue there. None. Everyone who's there chose to be there. And we get along great. It's just a relaxing, safe environment. And, you know, it's nice to have a real apartment with, like, a bathroom and a bedroom and a living room and a kitchen. That's amazing after a 10 by 11 room for you know, a couple of years.
Yeah, stability is invaluable. Roberto, you know, having a vision for Lavender Courtyard is one thing, but now taking it in and seeing people living there, what stands out to you? What resonates with you?
The story that Francesca tells. Francesca actually qualified as homeless, and Francesca wouldn't have identified as a homeless person. There are all types of homelessness, and it's impacting large swaths of our community. The story Francesca tells just warms our hearts. It's mission success. This is why we do what we do.
Yeah. Jessica, what are you comfortable sharing about your journey to coming out to those you love?
Knew what I was at a very young age. As a toddler, I started hiding before the age of three. The environment was really bad, and I just kept hiding. And I got married in the 80s, and I decided not to come out. Well, you can't wear a mask for forever. I tried. I became dysfunctional. I had a lot of suicidal ideations, and I came out to my spouse. And exactly 2 weeks later, I was on a 5150 hold, served with restraining order and divorce papers. I've lost everything. I've lost my family, most of my friends, all my resources. I was on the bubble of what I consider homelessness. Mm-hmm. I had a roof over my head, but housing instability is homelessness, so I guess I was. It's hard to think in those terms when other people are out on the street in tents or actually in the open sky. That's what really troubles me. When you see families on the street, whole families that can't get ahead or get back on track. And the senior population, whether it's LGBTQ or not, prices are going up so fast, I can't afford an apartment like I have currently. I can't. It's an amazing game changer. You know, seniors seem to get left behind regularly. And this is a step in the right direction, so we have a balanced community. I love it. It's amazing.
You know, and with the increasing cost of living and how rents are just going up and housing prices as well in recent years, there's also more competition for that unit, right? And that opens itself potentially to discrimination. You know, when it comes to the level of discrimination the LGBTQ plus community faces when it comes to housing, did you experience that?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Before I moved to Lavender Courtyard, I actually was renting a room from somebody who identifies as lesbian. Before that, it was really dicey. Finding a place to live is hard. I can't seem to find a job. You know, I did go to McGeorge. You know, I brought up my bar membership and active, but I'm an attorney, and I cannot find a job. The moment they find out I'm trans, that's it. You know, any reason to not hire me. It's really frustrating. So I'm on a fixed income.
You know, Roberto, you and your team obviously saw a problem, you know, and you wanted to solve it. That's why you created Lavender Courtyard. What can you tell us about what you hear and what you experience when it comes to the challenges of finding and getting actually into that unit when there are not enough units to go around?
Well, the first step is finding the units, right? And then they run into problems. As Francesca described, discrimination is pretty rampant. And then do they have the resources? We have somebody here who's willing and able to work, highly educated, much to offer, and can't seem to find work. So can they afford to pay the rent? You know, people find themselves homeless for no responsibility of their own. They're trying.
Yeah. What was the goal, or what is the goal of Mutual Housing California? This may be the first time a lot of people are hearing about your organization.
We are community builders. We build affordable housing so we can create community. So we are real estate developers and managers, and we also provide services to the folks who live in the housing, all levels of services, some for high needs and some which are just financial literacy or community building groups. But our goal is to build community and safe space for people. What I really want to see is people be able to integrate into the communities where they live. As one of my staff says, none of our communities is an island. All of our properties exist within larger communities, and we want people to have access to all the resources in those communities.
When you talk to developers, there are challenges when it comes to building costs, supply issues, regulations, and that can all increase what a property or what a unit will cost. How do you get around that so you can make a unit like a Lavender Courtyard affordable for people who are on a fixed income?
It's the biggest challenge we face today. It's probably the single biggest barrier. There are labor shortages. Those are driving up wages. And then there are material costs, and those are driving up the cost of development. Mm-hmm. It's a constant process all the way from planning the project through the final day of opening the doors. We are checking the costs constantly on a daily basis.
Well, and how do you determine the rent at Lavender Courtyard? Is it scaled or is it a flat fee?
They're scaled, and those rents are set through a process through HUD.
Given that you have a unique, basically a front seat to when it comes to housing and the rental market in Sacramento, what are some of the unique challenges our area faces, especially in recent years as this area has grown?
It's, you know, we say there are two major challenges to starting a project. One is finding the property, and the other is finding the money. There is land available in the greater Sacramento region, in Sacramento and Yolo counties. Properties available and relatively accessible. It may be fairly expensive, depending on where you want to build. So it's often challenging to develop in the most desirable areas, like Lavender Courtyard sits in Midtown. Often we're building further, closer to the outskirts. But then it's the resources, and historically there has not been money available locally to do development since 2009-2010. With the recent changes in 2018 through the state, Props 1 and 2, that leveraged a lot more access to funds. that drove everybody, all the developers with pent-up demand, back to the table. And the competition for funds is very fierce. And so the mayor locally yesterday made the announcement that the city is really trying to put forward a substantial amount of money to leverage 7 or 8 new affordable housing communities. That's huge. That's never happened before.
Wow. I mean, we're talking about huge macro challenges, but you lived through these challenges, Cheska. I mean, you yourself, you said that you moved 5 times since 2020. What do you think is missing from the conversation about affording a stable, consistent place to live in Sacramento?
I don't think there's anything missing from the conversation as such. I think nobody wants to have the conversation. I think everyone knows what it is. At Lavender Courtyard, I look out. I have a balcony. I look out my balcony, and there are homeless people everywhere. Downtown, off of 16th, F Street, not so many, but they're everywhere. And it's. I feel privileged having an apartment, but Lavender Courtyard is only a drop in the bucket. The conversation needs to be had. We need to stop ignoring issues. Nobody wants to see homeless. They want them off where they can't see them. I suggest every resident of Sacramento County just take light rail. Just take a light rail from downtown to Consumnes River College and then back. And look out those windows. You see the homeless camps. There are lots of them. They're homeless everywhere. And it's not, this issue is not being addressed. Lots of money seems to be spent on research, but nothing ever changes. It just gets worse and worse. So we need to have that conversation.
Yeah.
And stop ignoring it.
And building can take a long time, and it obviously doesn't meet the pace of a growing number of vulnerable people who are living on the streets. We have a record number of individuals who are experiencing homelessness across the state, including Sacramento. You mentioned that there's new projects that are hopefully popping up in Sacramento. What other projects is Mutual Housing California involved with in Sacramento or even throughout the state?
Yeah, Mutual Housing has a really aggressive goal to develop 1,000 more units of housing in the next 4 years. And we're well on the path. We have a housing community being developed in the rail yards right now. That's another 150 units of senior housing. It's right downtown, very accessible. We have a really interesting other community we're developing in South Sacramento in partnership with Habitat for Humanity at Greater Sacramento. So it's 108 rental units and 18 homes for sale. Mm.
Is Lavender Courtyard, I imagine it is it fully occupied?
Lavender Courtyard is. In fact, there are 200 people on the waiting list right now.
So for those 200 people and counting, because there may be people listening to this, what recommendations or advice do you have for people who are LGBTQ+, who are seniors or on a fixed income, that need an affordable place to live in Sacramento?
Perseverance. Right? And one of the challenges is you need to get your name on the list for the property. You can't just give your name to the company, the corporation, Mutual Housing California. So we have to have you get your name on the individual lists for each property. So that takes a fair amount of work and diligence, but it's doable. And they can access those websites to get their names on lists through our website, mutualhousing.com.
Yeah, Cheska, you went through this process. What advice do you have for people who are interested in something similar to this?
Fill out the applications. If there's a lottery, fill out the application immediately. For me, I went through the lottery, and I knew there would be a lot of people trying to get in. And I was number 5 on the list. So I was fortunate. But you have to apply. I applied the moment I heard the lottery was going to be open. I went for that application. Absolutely. I knew it was under development for years, and I was just waiting. You have to do the groundwork. And the application it may be long in detail because, it's needs-based. But it's all doable. Just get your pen and grab an application and fill it out. At Lavender Courtyard, the initial interest applications are posted at our gate, so people can walk up and just get one and get on the list. It's not hard.
Yeah, it's just doing it and kind of going through the process, which can be laborious and frustrating, but that's the process, right?
Yes.
And being patient. Given that you've now been living at Lavender Courtyard for a few months now, what is the sense of community like?
Oh, everyone gets along great. I mean, we have a community. It was interesting when it opened. I was among the first to get an apartment. And the initial influx was from people doing the lottery. And then we started getting people from the county. The initial influx, everyone got along immediately. Everyone was smiling, talking, engaging with one another. But when the county started sending people who were homeless or in bad situations, it was really interesting because when they came in, they were not friendly. They were not relating, you know, interacting with anybody, dour looks on their face. A month later, laughing, smiling, engaging, regaining their humanity. And it was amazing to watch. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. A home is so much more than a roof over your head, especially when it's a community like Lavender Courtyard.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it really has ripple effects far and beyond. Roberto, in the last few minutes we have Building Up 2022 this weekend. What is that all about?
That's our annual event. This year it's online. We've been doing our Building Up breakfast for a number of years. We haven't been able to do that in person for the last couple of years. So once again, we're doing it online. And people can sign up for the event at our website, mutualhousing.com.
Well, thank you so much. Jessica, I want to end with you. What do you want our listeners to take away from this conversation? Any final thoughts?
Having a home is important. I think it's something every human being needs. The sense of community, sense of family, a home that you can call your own. It doesn't matter the details on it, just as long as it exists. And, you know, mutual housing is doing big things in Sacramento County and Yolo County, but it's still a drop in the bucket. It's amazing that people ignore this crisis we have. And when you see families out on the street, whole families that can't bootstrap their way up because once you're homeless, you know, you're not taking showers regularly. You're not eating regularly. You don't have an address. You're stuck. And this dynamic needs to change, especially when it comes to the elderly. You know, we're a throwaway society. You hit retirement, that's it. If, you know, if things didn't go well for you, you're out on the street. And that's not acceptable. I think we need to adopt more of a European mentality where people get to live somewhere and be part of a community. And I'm grateful that Mutual Housing is attempting to do just that here.
Jessica and Roberto, thank you so much for joining us.
Right, thank you, Vicki.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Jessica Dixon is a resident of Sacramento's Lavender Courtyard, and Roberto Jimenez is the CEO of Mutual Housing California. Still ahead, in honor of Larry Itliong Day in California, we'll remember the late Filipino-American labor leader and, more broadly, the lesser-known contributions of Filipino farm workers. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Today is Larry Itliong Day, a Filipino activist and farm worker who is equally as important to the labor rights movement as Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. Yet, this extraordinary leader is often left out of history books. The Filipino activist worked diligently to form unions, set strikes, and advocate for senior housing for farm workers. Larry Itliong's journey is just one part of the overall Filipino-American experience, but an important part of not only Filipino history, but to American history. To discuss more about the mass migration and work of Filipinos like Larry Itliong, we're joined by Filipino-American scholar and Bulosan Center affiliate curator Manny De Leon. Manny, thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start with the Bulosan Center for Filipino Studies at UC Davis. How long has it been around?
The Bulosan Center for Davis is very recent. It's only been here for less than 10 years, and it's the first and only recognized studies research center in the UCs.
Wow, that is incredible. I mean, this whole conversation started because it's Larry Itliong Day, but it's also Filipino-American History Month. Where did this month and the celebration and acknowledgement begin?
Yeah, so academics and scholars in the community has recognized October as Phil-Am History Month specifically because of the numerous significance on October, specifically Larry Itliong's birthday, which is today, which is why we celebrate it. But also has been recognized federally by President Barack Obama and this year again by President Joe Biden.
You know, Larry was part of a mass migration of Filipinos to California. Give us a background of what led Filipinos to settling in the Central Valley.
Yeah. So when the Philippines became a U.S. protectorate in the 20s and 30s, a mass migration of Filipino manongs, which is an Ilocano word for older brother or older man, came to the Philippines to work en masse in Hawaii, in California, and throughout the West Coast. And a lot of them really settled in the major growing areas such as the Central Coast.
When you talk about this generation, the older generation, help us understand their contribution and the challenges they faced.
Yeah, so when a lot of these migrant workers came here to the States, they really came here to fill in a lot of these labor jobs that weren't being met because of Asian American exclusion during this time. And so they came in to work for a short time and temporarily go back home to the Philippines and support their families. But because of either anti-Asian rhetoric or more outright xenophobic hate, a lot of these folks weren't able to really settle or face a lot of obstacles trying to adapt and work here in the States.
When it comes to Larry Itliong, born in the Philippines, migrated to the United States, can you tell us about his drive, his motivation to make the daunting trip and where he bounced around before ending up in Delano?
Yeah, of course. So most of these manongs who came here to not just work and provide for their families, but they also wanted the opportunities to get an education. Larry himself wanted to become a lawyer and advocate for his community. But because of the injustices that he saw and faced, as well as shared with his fellow manongs and workers, he essentially took the step up to become a labor leader and advocate for the needs of his fellow Filipinos.
Yeah, and that brings me to the Delano Grape Script. It's one of the few civil rights events that's taught in schools. Cesar Chavez is often portrayed as the leader of this organization, but can you explain Larry Itliong's role in the strike and why this part of the story is often left out?
Yeah, so the Delano Grape Strike was initiated by AWOC, which is the farm workers union that the Filipinos consolidated against. And it wasn't until the Filipinos, specifically Larry, reaching out to Cesar Chavez and the Mexican farm workers union to come together and advocate for farm workers' rights across the board, regardless of being Filipino or being Mexican, did the United Farm Workers Union materialize to really advocate for all farm workers and unionizing in California and throughout the rest of the nation.
Given that Larry Itliong played a vital role in the United Farm Workers in the formation and the early years, what did he do for UFW during, you know, its inception, and what internal tensions led to his departure?
Yeah, so Larry and the Filipinos, recognizing the larger population of Mexican workers, saw that Cesar Chavez and the Mexican workers would have a larger say and larger presence in the movement. And so Larry ended up taking an assistant director position below Cesar Chavez, but still led a lot of the grassroots movements on the ground and really advocated for that.
Hmm. What would you like people to know about Larry Itliong's contribution to a labor movement that we tie to Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, but he played a vital role as well?
Yeah. So as much as Larry is the face of the Filipino American movement, right, he also did in collaboration with a larger group of Filipino organizers such as Philip Veracruz, Pete Velasco, and Chris Monsalves. And it's really a tribute to his community-oriented organizing and really advocating for those folks while working with those folks.
Mm. You know, given that just this year, UFW marched, they went on a pilgrimage to Delano near Bakersfield to Sacramento. It was like 330-plus miles in August to pressure Governor Newsom to sign an assembly bill to change voting for unionizing farm workers. What do you think Larry Itliong and the other Filipino activists in the labor movement, what do you think they would say about the current state of the UFW and the work being done?
I think they'd be supportive of the continued efforts, right? The legacies that the UFW is still continuing to this day, and the fact that they're still advocating for farm workers and union rights to this day. And yeah, I think they'd be proud of the work that's continuing.
Yeah. And what I'm hearing is that we're learning about a neglected piece of history, which I would imagine that led to the formation of the Bulosan Center at UC Davis, which is the only one of its kind across the UCs in the state.
Mm-hmm. Yes, like you mentioned, it's a neglected and often forgotten history of Filipino Americans. There is an historical amnesia when it comes to Filipino Americans just because of the ambiguity of the Filipino American identity and as well as their inclusion to larger, more broader movements such as the farm workers' movements with Mexicans as well as the Asian American movement in the 70s.
When I go back to the beginning of the migration of Filipino Americans to the Central Valley, Stockton has a large Filipino community. There's a designated Little Manila neighborhood. How did that come about? What happened to this neighborhood?
Yeah, so that was actually initiated by an organization called Little Manila Rising, and it's a it's part of a wider group, a wider organizing effort to really recognize the kind of concentrated ethnic enclaves that Filipinos concentrated at to recognize these different places. So like you mentioned, we have Little Manila Town in Stockton. We also have historic Filipino Town in L.A. And it's really to try to establish the physical presence of Filipino Americans here in the States, as well as to kind of highlight the contributions and tracking the movements of Filipino Americans here in California.
Yeah, this is coming at a time, especially in recent years, there's a progress in the representation of Filipino Americans. We have California Attorney General Rob Bonta, who says he grew up in a labor household. Former California Supreme Court Chief Justice Tani Gore Cantil Sacaulle, and in entertainment, household names like comedian Joy Coy, our managing editor is a fan of Joe Coy. These are among a wave of firsts and breaking barriers. What are your thoughts on this current representation?
Yeah, of course. Like this upcoming wave of representation is super neat to see, because growing up, I never had any of these names to recognize. I didn't see folks who looked like me, who had the same upbringing as me or had the same cultural background as me. And so being able to see it now is definitely beneficial, not just for myself and my generation, but for upcoming generations to be able to see folks who I've paved the way.
Yeah. For those listening to our conversation, what resources are available if someone wants to learn more about Filipino American, the experience, and also the contributions of leaders like Larry Itliong?
Yeah, of course. The best resources, if you have an Asian American studies class or a Filipino American studies class at your university, whether it be a four-year or community, that's one of the best places to go. You can also look at the Bulosan Center at UC Davis. We have resources and timelines and materials on our website. And just look up Filipino American books.
Manny, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Nice to see you. Manny De Leon is a Filipino-American scholar with the Bulosan Center for Filipino Studies at UC Davis. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, email us, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director and engineer is Mark Jones. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.